Buzz, this is Houston. F2, 1/160 of a second for shadow photography on the sequence camera.
Okay.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
At the foot of the ladder, the lamb footbeds are only depressed in the surface about 1 or 2 inches, although the surface appears to be very, very fine-grained as you get close to it. It's almost like a powder.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the show all about audiobooks recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. I'm your host Red Sail, and this week we're looking into space and celebrating 50 years since man first set foot on the moon. Andrew Smith reveals the stories of the men who walked on the moon in Moondust.
What you do after you've been to the moon, I mean, is the whole rest of your life going to be one big anticlimax?
Robert Kirkwood explores the works of fact and fiction inspired by space exploration.
It might not be possible to project a shot up to the moon.
And Commander Chris Hadfield remembers his reaction to watching Neil Armstrong's giant leap for mankind in 1969.
It was no longer a distant, unknowable orb, but a place where people walked and talked and worked and even slept. At that moment, I knew what I wanted to do with my life.
That's all coming up in today's Read On.
I'm going to step off the lamb now. It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Ah, yeah, I'm sorry, it's still not connecting.
Oh, is it? That's so weird.
Let's just do it via mobile, that's easier.
Sure.
This is author Andrew Smith, who joined me down the line via mobile after we couldn't get Skype to work. They can put a man in the moon, but we can't get two computers to talk to each other.
I know, yeah. The number of times I've heard that, it's true.
His book, Moondust, was first published in 2005 and has very recently been reissued with a new audio version for the 50th anniversary of the first moon landing. Only 12 people in history have ever stood on the moon. They were treated like heroes upon departure, rock stars upon return. They've even been credited with helping end the Cold War. NASA spent billions to give them the biggest rush any explorer has ever felt. So you can begin to appreciate the cosmic dimensions of their eventual midlife crises. After you've been to the moon, whatever do you do with the rest of your life? The new audio version is read by Matt Jamie.
With hindsight, the astronauts' reactions should have been predictable. Suddenly, the 12 had to find answers to a question that had never been asked in quite the same way before. Namely, where do you go after you've been to the moon? In addition to their own hopes and expectations, they had the fantasies of faceless millions at their backs and millennia's worth of lore. The Nepalese, for instance, believe that their dead reside on the moon. When the Apollo 14 veteran Stu Rusa visited there, he grew increasingly flustered at being asked, "So, did you see my grandmother?" The walkers will forever be caught between the gravitational pull of the moon and Earth's collective dreaming. Charlie Duke grew angry as he admitted getting letters from conspiracy theorists who hold that the moon landings were staged and call him a liar. I liked Duke. At the age of 64 he was still tall and handsome and spoke with a balmy drawl that seemed familiar, though it took a while for me to place it. I felt like a child lost in a favourite bedtime story as he described his flight and the striking luminescence of our world as it moves through the lonely black void of space. From the moon, he said, the planet was like a jewel, so colourful and bright that you felt you could reach up and grab it, hold it in your hands, and marvel at it like the precious thing it is.
That's a clip of Matt Jamie reading the recently reissued Moondust by Andrew Smith. And Andrew joins me down the line. Now, Andrew, this book started with an interview with Charlie Duke back in 1999.
Yeah, that's right. It was a fairly random thing, really. I was working at the Observer at the time on the magazine there mostly. And there used to be a bit at the back of the magazine that was just sort of a straight one-page question and answer thing. And I used to avoid it because you couldn't do much with it. You know, you couldn't be very creative with it or anything. But eventually, you know, the editor tapped me down and said, look, you haven't done one in a really long time. You've got to do one. And so I just sort of looked around about who I might talk to. And I found out that Charlie was in town with his wife, Dottie, who is quite a remarkable woman, I think. And he was, in doing the research, I found out that he was one of the ones who'd come back from the moon landings and really struggled to fit back into everyday life. A number of them did. And things had sort of gone quite wrong for he and Dottie, but she'd really very creatively, I think, put them back together through, you know, faith, religious faith. And so they were in London at the time talking about missionary work they were doing. And they were interesting and lovely people, actually. Charlie's very popular amongst all the other astronauts. But what I didn't know was that while we were there talking, that the previous day, one of the other astronauts had a motorbike accident, was expected to be fine. But as it turned out, he wasn't. And unexpectedly, word came through when I was with Charlie and Dottie that he died of his injury. And they were very upset because he was the man's name was Pete Conrad, and he commanded the second mission. He was a very, very popular member of the astronaut corps. And so they were really upset. And then I stayed talking to them for longer. And as I was getting up to go, Charlie just said, now there's only 9 of us. And that really struck me, and it stuck in my head because it made me think, well, actually, one day there won't be anyone who's still on the moon, on Earth. When I was still thinking about that a couple of years later, I decided that I really wanted to go and find out why it made me feel sad, that feeling, and also to answer the question, what you do after you've been to the moon. I mean, is the whole rest of your life going to be one big anticlimax? So that was sort of how it came about.
And of course, there were 9 alive at the time of writing, and now there's only just 4 remaining.
That's right. Yeah, I know I laugh at myself in my younger self who thought, oh my God, they're in their late 60s. They're not going to be around for much longer. And I remember Alan Bean having a little chuckle about that. But they've, you know, NASA tested them thoroughly and chose them well. So they really have. But then there was, you know, they were all still here for a good long while, you know, happily. But in the last few years, yes, we have started to lose them at more of a rate. Yeah, I'm really glad that I did it when I did.
And reading your website, it would appear that obviously the death of Neil Armstrong hit you the hardest.
Well, he did hit me hard, yes. But I think that, you know, shared with many, many, many people, because he was obviously the most well-known of them all. And, you know, I always think he handled that bizarre position he was in very, very well. I mean, in personal terms, actually, I would say that there were 2 others that affected me more, which was Edgar Mitchell, who I really admired and liked very much, as I did Armstrong too. But I had more to do with Edgar, and I think he was a really unusual, unexpected person to find in that position, you know, having walked on the moon and been an astronaut. And also Alan Bean, he was the one I really stayed in touch with afterwards and had a lot to do with. And he's the one who came back and went on one of the most unexpected paths that he took after his moon landing, which is he stayed with NASA for a while, working on Skylab in the 70s, but then decided he wanted to become a painter. He'd always been creative and an artist. He was a gymnast at college and stuff like that. And so he did. He became a painter. He just painted scenes from the moon landing for the rest of his life. And was one of the most contented people I ever met, I think. So he was a really fabulous character, him.
Yeah, they were kind of portrayed in the 50s and 60s and even 70s as kind of jocks, pilot jocks and fighter jets, but they're really quite complex men.
Yeah, they're not. It's funny that, because there are a number of things that, I mean, I was constantly surprised when I met them. The first one that I went to meet after Charlie Duke, obviously, was Edgar Mitchell. And you could not find, if you tried to design
a human being who is not the image of the stereotypical image of the fighter jock, man of steel, he's pretty much what you'd come up with. He was he meditated every day. He was intensely open-minded. He thought that he'd detected a consciousness in the universe as he was coming back. And he was a scientist. He didn't believe it was a mystical thing, except that he ended up developing a kind of almost a mystical theory of the universe, although it's all science-based and based on atoms. And he spent the rest of his life trying to work out what that feeling was that he felt on the way back from the moon, and which he decided was consciousness, and then trying to work out, well, what do we mean by that? What is it? Which is obviously one of science's great mysteries. And, was as open-minded a human being as you're ever going to meet. So none of them were chosen with PR in mind, and none of them were chosen to be because they were steely astronauts either. They were chosen because they were really, really good at what they did and very clever. Most of them were pilots. Many of them were test pilots. Majority of them, I would say, were test pilots. So they were brilliant flyers. But most of them also had postgraduate degrees in engineering, science, things like that.
And as focused as they were up there, they did have those moments of reflection. I'm reminded of the story Neil Armstrong told about how he held his thumb up and blocked out the entire Earth.
Yeah, I know. It's the thing that I like about that story is that someone said to him, did that make you feel big? And he said, no, it made me feel really, really small. So he had a sense. There's something very different about going to the moon. Everyone's surprised when you say this, including me, actually, and I know it. No one's left Earth orbit since 1972, since the last Apollo mission came back. And it's a really different thing. We've been up in space. Space is now part of the human environment, but it's only up to, say, 200 miles up. That's what we've done since. And it's a different experience, because from up there, the Earth is huge and majestic, for sure. But it's only when you move away from it starts to get small. And I think that's when you see it in a cosmic perspective. And I think that's what the Apollo astronauts were really moved by.
The astronauts themselves, it didn't exactly set them up for life going to the moon, because they weren't really paid very well.
No, well, most of them were paid according to the ones who were military were paid according to their rank. And, the American military at that time was not particularly well paid. They weren't all military, by the way. Armstrong wasn't. He was a civilian test pilot for NASA, but had come through the military. So no, they didn't make a lot of money. And then, of course, at the end of 72, the whole thing stopped. So where they thought that they'd been pioneers on a new frontier and were going to carry on doing what they'd trained so hard, for up to a decade to do, suddenly it stopped and they had to go and find other stuff. Most of them were around about the age of 40, which can be a tricky time anyway. And so they had to go and find new jobs and careers. And it was odd, because some of them, Buzz Aldrin was selling cars in a car dealership within a few years of coming back. One of them, Jim Lovell, who commanded Apollo 13, he went and he was piloting tugboats on the Houston Ship Canal and then running a company that ran tugboats. I found one of the command module pilots, the ones who didn't land, who stayed in the spaceship orbiting the moon while the others went. I found signing autographs at the Star Trek convention in Las Vegas, with big queues at the tables of all the actors who were playing space people. And then, tiny little queue at the table of this man who'd actually been. So, yeah, they had a lot to deal with when they came back, most of them.
Who do you think was changed the most by the experience?
Well, the interesting thing about that is that was one of my questions when I set off to find them. How did it change them? What were the changes? What were the things that caused the changes? Most of the astronauts that I've spoken to that had thought about that, I think Alan Bean was the first one who said it to me, he said, I don't think anyone did change. I think everyone came back more like they already were, which I think is probably true. Those who had a religious bent came back with their religion affirmed and were more passionate about it. Those who came back, who went as, scientists, essentially came back even more, with more scientific questions and so on. And that does seem to be the case, that it galvanized them rather than changed them, I think. It changed their perspective on the Earth. I think so they would all agree with that.
Now, Moondust has been reissued with a brand new audio version read by Matt Jamie. What's new in the reissued version?
Well, I wrote a new. It's funny because I wanted to do a new edition because I never loved the previous one so much. I didn't like the cover, and so when I said to Bloomsbury, "Hey, look, why don't we do this? You'll do a new one." And normally, what they like you to do is to do, you know, a new foreword or something like that. And I said, "Well, look, I don't want to do a foreword because I did that for the previous one, and it spoils the book for me because I think you spend a lot of time thinking about how to start a book, and why put something new in between, in front of the start?" And I always slightly regretted that. And so I said, "Well, look, I will do you, and I will write a new afterward." And then when I started to do it, and they said, "Yeah, that's fine." And when I started to do the afterward, I started writing, and I realized there was more I wanted to say than I'd realized when I'd first suggested it. And ended up writing basically a new chapter. So it's a 10th chapter to the book, which really updates it and talks about some of the interactions I have with the astronauts after finishing the book and about the direction that space has gone in, because it's changed dramatically since I was doing Moondust, when, you know, the thing that interested me about it was the extent to which it had been forgotten, and the astronauts had been forgotten, and no one was talking about going to space. It was really just something that we weren't going to do and weren't interested anymore. And then look at it now. We're flying into space all over the place, and there are lots and lots of people pushing it. And I do think we have to credit Elon Musk with who I've met and interviewed and write about in the afterwards. I do think we have to credit him with quite a lot of that, actually. So that's new. And it's got a beautiful new cover, which we worked very hard at. And I really like that too. I have to say, I love Jamie's reading of the book too. I read the original audiobook, which gave me huge respect for actors, because I think it's the most tiring thing I've ever done in my life. When I finished it, I just went and collapsed in my hotel room bed. Did not get up for about 14 hours because it was so tiring. And I think he's done a wonderful job with it. I like his reading very much.
Yeah, people don't understand just how tiring reading a book is. Just that level of concentration is...
Yeah. keeping your energy up, you know, for those periods of time. It's sort of like 8-hour days, and I found it very difficult. I enjoyed it after the fact, but to say that I enjoyed it during the fact would be a gross exaggeration.
Now, you talked about Elon Musk and the future of space exploration. Do you think we will go back?
Yeah, it looks pretty inevitable now. I wouldn't have said that 5 years ago, but it does. It seems that pretty much everyone is talking about going. I mean, probes are being sent already. China has already you know, sent them, and I do think now that is likely to happen. My fear is that it's going to be viewed as just another source of natural resources that we can go and chomp up and destroy. So I'm hoping that that's not going to be what happens, but we'll see. And there's a lot of interest in the public now, which I think wasn't there to the same extent before. So it may well be that, taxpayers, again, as in the 60s, are prepared to front the bill. I mean, Mars, I think, is much further away because that's much more difficult. But going to the moon, we should be able to do relatively cheaply compared to the 60s, probably because our technology is so much better.
Now, given that you've talked to 9 out of the 12 people who've walked on the moon, what would you say to the new pioneers who hopefully will end up there?
Yeah, you'd have to imagine that the next phase will be a moon base at some point, which NASA is already talking about. I don't know. It's such a different thing because now they have so much more scrutiny and attention on them the whole time. I think the big difference between then and now is the 24-hour news cycle, which means that they're going to have scrutiny and attention focused on them the whole time, and people will all be looking for different angles because there's space to be filled in online and in on the airways and so on. And so they're going to need to be a lot tougher emotionally, probably, than they had to be first time around. They'll probably need to be less technically experienced than they would have been the first time. I mean, I think now they could probably send anyone for most of the roles that will go up, rather as on the space shuttle, which would be exciting because it means we could send scientists, we could send poets and writers, things like that. So that'll be good. But yeah, I mean, the advice would just be would be suited to that and be ready for that, which was not any kind of a consideration first time around.
Now, we've talked about Matt's reading of your book. Is it important that it is available in alternative formats for everyone?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, the audiobooks are one of the sort of growth areas of book publishing generally. So even sighted readers like them. So, yeah, it's crucially important. And I'm as concerned with that as I am the print book. I chose Matt from a range of options, and it was very important to me. I made it a condition that I had to approve the reader.
Andrew Smith, thank you so much for joining us on RNIB Connect Radio.
Oh, thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks to Robert and to Andrew Smith. Moondust, In Search of the Men Who Fell to Earth, is available from the RNIB Library as TB14481. And Andrew will be back at the end of the show to share the books of his life. You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, Commander Chris Hadfield recalls his time aboard the International Space Station. But first, Moondust is, of course, far from the only book to be inspired by the events of July the 20th, 1969. Authors have been exploring space through fact and fiction for years, as Robert discovered when he touched down in the RNIB Talking Books Library.
50 years ago, the first two humans landed on the moon. This huge achievement for the time was made possible by a team of more than 400,000 men and women here on Earth. To celebrate this great human achievement, I thought I'd have a look through the RNIB Talking Books Library to find some books inspired by that event and inspired by the moon itself, both fact and fiction. And first up, arguably the first book about travelling to the moon, by Jules Verne, From the Earth to the Moon. It is the year 1865, and following the end of the American Civil War, the members of the Baltimore Gun Club are restless and want to seek new ways of using their genius for invention and discovery. So their president, Impey Barbicane, sets his fellows a challenge to construct a rocket which can reach the moon.
The means of arriving thither are simple, easy, certain, infallible. And that is the purpose of my present proposal. A storm of acclamations greeted these words. There was not a single person in the whole audience who was not overcome, carried away, lifted out of himself by the speaker's words. "Hear, hear! Silence!" resounded from all sides. As soon as the excitement had partially subsided, Barbicane resumed his speech in a somewhat graver voice. "You know," said he, "what progress artillery science has made during the last few years, and what a degree of perfection firearms of every kind have reached. Moreover, you are well aware that in general terms the resisting power of cannon and the expansive force of gunpowder are practically unlimited. Well, starting from this principle, I ask myself whether, supposing sufficient apparatus could be obtained, constructed upon the conditions of ascertained resistance, it might not be possible to project a shot up to the moon."
The wonderful voice of Garrick Hagen reading From the Earth to the Moon by Jules Verne. And from early science fiction to early science fact, Rocket Men, the epic story of the first men on the moon by Craig Nelson. This text follows the story of the Lunar Project, beginning at its inception at the start of the Cold War and tracing it through to its finest hour with the first moon landing and the astronauts' safe return. Through extensive interviews with astronauts, NASA staff and their families, and never-before-published documents, Craig Nelson presents an awe-inspiring human account of the voyage that changed the course of history.
Before getting to ride their rocket, Armstrong, Aldrin, and Collins each spent 2.5 years amassing over 2,000 hours of formal training. Dave Scott, who served with Neil Armstrong on Gemini 8, kept a detailed journal of his own Apollo regimen for the year 1966. 270 hours on operations, 300 hours on systems, 350 on equipment design, 370 on spacecraft tests, and 680 in module simulations. Besides working in NASA's own trainers in Houston, Kennedy, and Edwards, Apollo crews tested the command module at North American's Downey, California plant, and the lunar module at Grumman in Bethpage, Long Island. Armstrong's direct training for Apollo 11 totaled 959 hours, with 285, 30%, spent in LM simulators. Aldrin logged 1,017 hours of training, with 332 hours, 33%, in the LM. But these numbers did not include the time spent in camera lessons, astronomy class, the gym, giving press interviews, or the hundreds of hours of travel time in T-38s between Downey and Grumman and Kennedy and Houston, or to Panama for survival training, or to the Gulf of Mexico for water landings, or to the Texas Big Bend, the Grand Canyon, Arizona's meteor and sunset craters, and an Oregon lava field for geology field trips, or to the dozens of other locations housing specialized machinery for education that only NASA could conceive. Even so, training was only about one-third of our time and effort, Neil Armstrong added. A third had to do with planning, figuring out techniques and methods that would allow us to achieve the trajectories and the sequence of events and the ways of picking from the available strategies the one that might work the best.
Rocket Men by Craig Nelson is read for you by Peter Brook. We've already heard from Jules Verne, but that voyage to the moon was already imagined by another classic science fiction master, H.G. Wells, in this dramatization of The First Men in the Moon.
50 feet, Professor, and dropping.
We'll be landing soon.
20 feet, 10 feet.
We're rolling over.
Hold on.
Welcome to the moon, everyone.
Professor, is that you? I looked out, but now I can't see.
The light has burnt out his eye.
Something touched me. Wet, slimy. Can you see it?
Something's in here, Gibbs.
You mad, Professor. I think I love you.
Gidford, run.
I don't want to run. I want to die.
We present James Bolam as Bedford and Donald Sinden as Professor Cavour in First Men in the Moon by H.G. Wells.
The voices of Donald Sinden, James Boland and others as they journey through space to man's first incredible voyage to the moon. And also available, and once again moving from science fiction to science fact, an incredible dual biography called Two Sides of the Moon, Our Story of the Cold War Space Race, by David Scott and Alexei Leonov, with a foreword by Neil Armstrong and an introduction by Tom Hanks. The two authors grew up on either side of the Iron Curtain, but shared the same dream, to fly. They became elite fighter pilots and were chosen by their country's space programs to take part in the space race to land a man on the moon. In this dual autobiography, they recount their exceptional lives and careers. They tell of missions fraught with perilous risks, adventure, heroism, and tragedy.
United States President John F. Kennedy asked the National Aeronautics and Space Administration to report on our ability to successfully compete with the Soviets. The NASA officials told the president that the United States could not provide the first space laboratory and only had a slim chance of flying around the moon first, but would have a chance, with a concerted national effort, to land a man on the moon first. Although this was an arena in which he knew little, Kennedy concluded that the United States must be in the race and must perform well. He received the support of the Congress and of the American people. The race was underway. This book is the story of that race as told by two of the principal competing participants. Each side respected the other. They were, in fact, able to understand, perhaps better than anyone, the problems, challenges, and risks before them. On rare occasions, the competitors met at international events and technical conferences for short periods and found that they liked one another, although, coming from opposing sides, they did not know whether they could trust one another. Two Sides of the Moon interweaves the tactics of the Soviet program with those of the American effort. The reader will see the plans being developed in the training and operation centers in Moscow and Houston, and will live with the cosmonauts and astronauts inside their spacecraft as they learn to exist and survive in dangerous and inhospitable space. Dave Scott and Alexei Leonov have each borne the enormous responsibility of commanding spacecraft and of representing their respective countries in the most fascinating and most expensive race in human history. This is their transcendent recounting of that competition. Neil Armstrong, 2004.
Two Sides of the Moon, our story of the Cold War space race, by David Scott and Alexei Leonov, is read by Cameron Rhodes. And finally, a blend of science fiction and science fact, as we set our sights further afield and have a listen to Mission to Mars, My Vision for Space Exploration, by Buzz Aldrin. Legendary space statesman Buzz Aldrin speaks out as a vital advocate for the continuing quest to push the boundaries of the universe as we know it. As a pioneering astronaut who set foot on the moon during mankind's first landing with Apollo 11, and an aerospace engineer who designed an orbital rendezvous technique critical to future planetary landings, Aldrin has a vision. And in Mission to Mars, he plots the path he proposes, one that will take humans to Mars by 2035.
It was April 15th, 2010, when I stepped off Air Force One, one of several guests invited to travel with U.S. President Barack Obama to the John F. Kennedy Space Center at Merritt Island, Florida. I had some inkling that he was going to push the reset button on the U.S. space program. As he began a formal address, President Obama was kind enough to recognize me among those gathered. It was certainly ego-lifting to hear him say, "Four decades ago, Buzz became a legend. But in the four decades since, he's also been one of America's leading visionaries and authorities on human spaceflight." Welcomed words, but I patiently waited the punchlines of his speech. Now, I understand that some believe that we should attempt a return to the surface of the moon first, as previously planned, the president said. But I have to say, pretty bluntly here, we've been there before. Buzz has been there. There's a lot more of space to explore, and a lot more to learn when we do. Obama then called for a series of increasingly demanding targets, made feasible by advancing our technological capacity with each progressive step forward. Early in the next decade, a set of crewed flights will test and prove the systems required for exploration beyond low Earth orbit. And by 2025, we expect new spacecraft designed for long journeys to allow us to begin the first ever crewed missions beyond the moon into deep space. So we'll start by sending astronauts to an asteroid for the first time in history. By the mid-2030s, I believe we can send humans to orbit Mars and return them safely to Earth. And a landing on Mars will follow. And I expect to be around to see it, the president explained, greeted by bursts of applause throughout the rollout of his prospective missions.
Buzz Aldrin's Mission to Mars, My Vision for Space Exploration, is read for you by John Pruden. For more information on any of these books, or indeed any books in the RNIB library, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Now, before we hear the books of Andrew Smith's life, the moon landings inspired a whole generation to think beyond its physical boundaries, and made many a small child dream of becoming an astronaut. One who both dared to dream and succeeded is Commander Chris Hadfield, as he told Robert Kirkwood.
Colonel Chris Hadfield had spent decades training as an astronaut and now has logged nearly 4,000 hours in space. During this time, he's broken into a space station with a Swiss Army knife, disposed of a live snake while piloting a plane, been temporarily blinded while clinging to the exterior of an orbiting spacecraft, and became a YouTube sensation with his performance of David Bowie's Space Oddity.
Ground control to Major Tom. Lock your Soyuz hatch and put your helmet on.
In his book, An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, Chris Hadfield takes readers deep into his years of training and space exploration to show how to make the impossible possible.
We didn't have a television set, but our neighbors did. And very late on the evening of July 20th, 1969, we traipsed across the clearing between our cottages and jammed ourselves into their living room along with just about everybody else on the island. Dave and I perched on the back of a sofa and craned our necks to see the screen. Slowly, methodically, a man descended the leg of a spaceship and carefully stepped onto the surface of the moon. The image was grainy, but I knew exactly what we were seeing. The impossible made possible.
Chris Hadfield reading from his book, An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth. But he's on a new mission with his latest children's book, The Darkest Dark, to encourage children all over the world and of any ability to reach for the stars. He joined me on the line and first of all told me about the book.
One of the problems that all of us face, I think, is how do you deal with risk and danger and fear in your life? And I think it's especially true when you're younger because you haven't developed so many of the skills you need. And so everything is a little bit fear-inducing. And if you don't know what to be afraid of, then everything makes you fearful. And I think one of the most common fears when we're little is fear of the dark. It's sort of a natural, evolved fear. And what I wanted to try and emphasize to young people is that it's okay to be afraid. But the real key to trying to grow up and trying to be somebody is to figure out how to be brave, even though acknowledging that you're going to continue to be afraid. And of course, there's a difference between danger and fear. And I've spoken to adults on it on many different times, TED Talks and things. But the real purpose of this book, The Darkest Dark, was to talk about fear for young ones and how to find your inner bravery to do the things that you're dreaming of.
What sort of influences came from your own life?
I grew up out on a farm. We were growing corn and in a big old farmhouse in Canada, a farmhouse built in the 1840s, which for Canada is very old. And as a result, it's a big old creaky house with drafts and noises and barns. And to be a little kid in an environment like that is pretty daunting. A lot of darkness. It's not like living in a place with streetlights and modern conveniences. And so I remember very distinctly being right at the edge of my ability to function, to go out to the barns at night to feed the horses or to laying in my bed and listening and imagining all the things that were happening in the darkness. And yet I went on to do spacewalks to fly a spaceship into the ultimate darkness that exists, which is leaving the Earth and entering into the infinite blackness of outer space itself. And somewhere along the way, I realized the beauty of and the depth and the palpable tangibility of the darkness, but also the fact that that your dreams and hopes often occur while it's dark. And then you try and put them into practice while it's light. And so I thought it would be, after talking with my wife and working with folks, I just thought that would be a lovely topic for this book. And we found two fellows to make the imagery, and then I wrote a song about it. And between the whole group, I'm very happy with the result. And watching the result now with the children and hearing the delight in their voices and helping them potentially not be afraid. To me, that's a wonderful position to be in.
And you read the audio version?
I did. I recorded an audio version of my first book, Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, and also of this book. There's an audio version available as well. To me, it's really important, and all of the stuff that I put on social media, all of the YouTube videos that we've made as well, have closed captioning on them, because of course it's important to me to try and have as many people be able to understand and hear and see and have access to the ideas of space travel that I possibly can.
The room erupted in amazement. The adults shook hands, the kids yelped and whooped, and somehow we felt as if we were up there with Neil Armstrong, changing the world. Later, walking back to our cottage, I looked up at the moon. It was no longer a distant, unknowable orb, but a place where people walked and talked and worked and even slept. At that moment, I knew what I wanted to do with my life. I was going to follow in the footsteps so boldly imprinted just moments before, roaring around in a rocket, exploring space, pushing the boundaries of knowledge and human capability. I knew with absolute clarity that I wanted to be an astronaut.
What sort of books did you read when you were growing up, and have they had any influence?
I read fanciful books, of course, science fiction and adventure books, Jules Verne and Edgar Rice Burroughs and Arthur C. Clarke and Ray Bradbury and all of those. And they, to me, they were so different than the actual life I was living, so much wider and wilder and unfettered. And I think it really helped me to dream. It helped me to imagine myself doing things that otherwise I probably never could have given myself permission to picture. And amazingly enough, a lot of those things that those early science fiction authors predicted, or I don't know if they predicted them, but they imagined anyway, have since become reality. And to me, that's just a delight. And the fact that I've been able to be part of that transition from wild childhood fantasy and imagining right through to actually walking in space and commanding a spaceship.
The Jules Verne book, From the Earth to the Moon, where they just fire a projectile onto the moon's surface, that would have put me off becoming an astronaut.
I wasn't really inspired by that one. The one that really inspired me by Jules Verne was Mysterious Island, because it was the real adventure tale of exploration, but also of human ingenuity, of relying on our own skill, our own learned capabilities, our own ability to work together as a team to then prevail and accomplish and understand and succeed in a place that otherwise would have never allowed us to do any of those things. And I think even I read that book quite young and recently reread it, and the protagonist, who's Cyrus Harding or Cyrus Smith, depending on which translation version you read, to me is sort of the prototype for who I wanted to become. And I recently discovered that Jules Verne even gave him a mustache, which may have been very formative for me in my own choices of what I how much of my face I shave.
Did you take books with you up to the ISS?
Most of the books on the ISS, of course, are electronic, just because we try and save weight. Mm. But there are advantages to having a book in hand. They're just, you know, you can, it's just kind of a nice palpable thing and a link with home. So there are a few printed books on board, but most of the books are electronic, either spoken books where the author has read them so that you can listen to them while you're working on, or exercising or something, or just digital books you can read.
There seems something so relaxing about just being weightless and reading a book.
Yeah, it's just there's so little time. Really, the only time I had to read up there was while I was exercising, and we have to exercise 2 hours a day, or just before I went to sleep at night. I would read just to give my brain a chance to sort of settle into a pattern that would let me sleep. But the rest of the time, you're very much oversubscribed for work, so it's not a place you can just steal time and go read.
Now, The Darkest Dark is out now. Where can people get the book?
Oh, in any of the bookstores. It's also available online. Probably the easiest is if you go to just my own website, chrishadfield.ca, CA for Canada, chrishadfield.ca, and it will list all of the places through all of the online sellers, but also in bookstores all over the place, in all of its various versions. And it's already, I think, in six countries or six languages and multiple countries and spreading. So hopefully as widely available as we can make it.
Colonel Chris Hadfield, thank you so much for joining me today on RNIB Connect Radio.
Nice to speak with you. Thank you.
Thanks to Robert Kirkwood and to Chris Hadfield.
RNIB Library has all the latest reading titles in a format that suits your needs. You choose the books, you choose the format, we deliver to your door. Follow us on Twitter at RNIB Library or find us on Facebook. The Moth.
I'm Jay Allison. Join us for more true personal stories told live on stage. No scripts, no notes, no nothing. Each Moth Radio Hour is a mix of funny and heartbreaking tales that captivate and surprise and delight audiences around the world with their honesty and bravery and humor. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Wednesdays from 8 p.m. and Sundays at 11 a.m. on RNIB Connect Radio.
Now it's back to Moondust author Andrew Smith for the books of his life. Now, Andrew, was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
I'd have to say there were two, actually. I mean, I loved reading and writing anyway, and I think the first job I can really remember wanting to do was to write for Mad Magazine. But there were two books. There was one which I chose from the school library. I spent the first 13 years of my life in California, in America. And I remember there was this book in the school library, which I'd never seen anyone take out again, and it was The Secret Garden. And I think I just liked the title of it. And I remember my teacher, my male teacher, looking at it and going, "What, really? You want to read that?" And I did, and I loved that. I found that captivating. And then a little bit later after that was To Kill a Mockingbird, which remains one of my very favorite books. And I actually made a documentary about it for BBC Four at one point. And so that, I mean, it would be impossible to overestimate how important that was to my own love of reading and writing.
She went skipping slowly down the outside walk, thinking him over and saying to herself that, queer as it was, here was another person whom she liked, in spite of his crossness. She liked old Ben Weatherstaff. Yes, she did like him. She always wanted to try to make him talk to her. Also, she began to believe that he knew everything in the world about flowers. There was a laurel-hedged walk which curved round the secret garden and ended at a gate which opened into a wood in the park. She thought she would skip round this walk and look into the wood and see if there were any rabbits hopping about. She enjoyed the skipping very much, and when she reached the little gate, she opened it and went through because she heard a low, peculiar whistling sound and wanted to find out what it was. It was a very strange thing indeed. She quite caught her breath as she stopped to look at it. A boy was sitting under a tree with his back against it, playing on a rough wooden pipe. He was a funny-looking boy, about 12. He looked very clean, and his nose turned up, and his cheeks were as red as poppies. And never had Mistress Mary seen such a round and such blue eyes in any boy's face.
When he was nearly 13, my brother Jem got his arm badly broken at the elbow. When it healed, and Jem's fears of never being able to play football were assuaged, he was seldom self-conscious about his injury. His left arm was somewhat shorter than his right. When he stood or walked, the back of his hand was at right angles to his body, his thumb parallel to his thigh. He couldn't have cared less, so long as he could pass and punt. When enough years had gone by to enable us to look back on them, we sometimes discussed the events leading to his accident. I maintain that the Yules started it all. But Jem, who was 4 years my senior, said it started long before that. He said it began the summer Dill came to us, when Dill first gave us the idea of making Boo Radley come out.
The Secret Garden by Frances Hodgson Burnett and To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee are both available in Braille, giant print and audio. Secret Garden is read by John Currell and is TB443. Mockingbird is read by Marvin Kane and is TB2289. And is there a book that you go back to again and again to reread?
Yes, that's actually shockingly easy for me. It's The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test by Tom Wolfe, who's a writer that I really adore. And I have to make sure that I'm not reading him or haven't recently read him when I'm writing something, because otherwise I can do a parody of him like you wouldn't believe, which is no good for my own work. But it's the story of the early hippies and their discovery of LSD. And it centers around Ken Kesey, who wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and was in San Francisco in the Bay Area. And he and his group, the Merry Pranksters, just got on a bus and drove across America. And so it's about that. And it so captures the 1960s and the spirit of the counterculture that I love that book. And it's one that I have read a number of times and probably will be reading for the rest of my life.
Cool Breeze is a kid with 3 or 4 days' beard, sitting next to me on the stamped metal bottom of the open back part of a pickup truck, bouncing along, dipping and rising and rolling on these rotten springs like a boat. Out the back of the truck, the city of San Francisco is bouncing down the hill, all those endless staggers of bay windows, slums with a view, bouncing and streaming down the hill. One after another, electric signs with neon martini glasses lit up on them. The San Francisco symbol of bar. Thousands of neon magenta martini glasses bouncing and streaming down the hill. And beneath them, hundreds, thousands of people wheeling around to look at this freaking crazed truck we're in. Their white faces erupting from their lapels like marshmallows, streaming and bouncing down the hill. And God knows, they've got plenty to look at. That's why it strikes me as funny when Cool Breeze says very seriously over the whole roar of the thing, "I don't know. When Kesey gets out, I don't know if I can come around the warehouse." "Why not?" "Well, like the cops are going to be coming around like all feisty. And I'm on probation, so I don't know."
The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test by Tom Wolfe is available commercially in audio, as read by Luke Daniels. And is there a book that you've recently read? Doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but is there something you've recently read that you'd like to recommend?
Yeah, I mean, there are loads, actually. I'm tempted to say A Visit by the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan, which I absolutely adored. But the one that I think made the biggest impact on me was Independence Day by Richard Ford, who was a writer that I hadn't read at all until a few years ago. And I can't remember who recommended it. I think it was a friend said, "Oh, you really should read Richard Ford." And I read it, and I felt depressed as I was reading it that I had only just discovered this writer. One of those things I thought, my feeling was, well, how many other writers as good as this are there in the world that I haven't read and don't know? But I think, you know, he's a rare one. Independence Day, I just think it's the most wonderful book, and it's part of a series, in fact. So I was then able to go and read the other. There were two at the time. He's published another. So that I couldn't recommend too highly. I think it's a wonderful book.
In Haddam, summer floats over tree-softened streets like a sweet lotion balm from a careless, languorous god, and the world falls in tune with its own mysterious anthems. Shaded lawns lie still and damp in the early a.m. Outside, on peaceful morning Cleveland Street, I hear the footfalls of a lone jogger tramping past and down the hill toward Taft Lane and across to the choir college, there to run in the damp grass. Men sit on stoops, pant legs rolled above their sock tops, sipping coffee in the growing, easeful heat. The marriage enrichment class, 4 to 6, has let out at the high school, its members sleepy-eyed and dazed, bound for bed again. While on the green gridiron pallet, our varsity band begins its 2-a-day drills, revving up for the 4th. boom, had 'em, boom, had 'em, boom, boom, ba, boom. Had 'em, up and at 'em, boom, boom, ba, boom. Elsewhere up the seaboard, the sky, I know, reads hazy. The heat closes in, a metal smell clocks through the nostrils. Already the first clouds of a summer tea storm lurk on the mountain horizons, and it's hotter where they live than where we live. Far out on the main line, the breeze is right to hear the Amtrak, the merchant special, hurtle past for Philly. And along on the same breeze, a sea salt smell floats in from miles and miles away, mingling with shadowy rhododendron aromas and the last of the summer's staunch azaleas. Though back on my street, the first shaded block of Cleveland, sweet silence reigns. A block away, someone patiently bounces a driveway ball. Squeak. Then breathing. Then a laugh, a cough.
All right, that's the way.
None of it too loud.
Independence Day by Richard Ford, and indeed all four of the Frank Bascom books are available as talking books. Independence Day is read by Jack Roberts, and it's TB10765. A Visit from the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan is also available as TB19978, and it's also available in giant print. Andrew Smith, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading and writing with the Read On listeners.
What a total pleasure, yeah, thank you.
Don't forget that you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, that's REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at talking_books. So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.